The ridge inclined ahead, and I fought my way up, my strength beginning to wane. At the top of the rise, the ground leveled out and was thick with tall trees and lush undergrowth. Rising behind them was a sheer rock face that I had to scale delicately, searching for hand and footholds as I proceeded. I struggled to the top, and my heart fell at the sight before me. A drop-off of 100 feet or more blocked my way. I could go no further. I was doomed. Finished. Rocks slid along the outcropping behind me, indicating the soldier was closing fast. I sank to my knees. I was exhausted, spent, and with a final sigh, I released the last of my fight, accepting my fate. Soon I knew the bullets would come, and interestingly, as an end to the terror, death seemed almost a welcome relief. As I waited, my mind flashed to childhood Sundays and to the innocent contemplation of God. What would it be like, death? I tried to open myself to the experience. After a long period of waiting, during which I had no concept of time, I suddenly became aware that nothing had happened. I looked around and noticed for the first time that I was positioned on the highest peak of the mountain. Other ridges and cliffs fell away from this point, leaving me with a panoramic view in all directions. A movement caught my eye. There, far down the slope toward the south, walking casually away from me, was the soldier, the gun belonging to Jensen's man, slung across one arm. The sight warmed my body and filled me with ripples of silent laughter. I had somehow survived. I turned and sat cross-legged and savored the euphoria. I wanted to stay here forever. The day was brilliant with sunshine and blue sky. As I sat there, I was struck by the closeness of the purple hills in the distance, or rather, the feeling that they were close. The same perception applied to the few puffs of white cloud drifting overhead. I felt as if I could reach out and touch them with my hand. As I reached up toward the sky, I noticed something different about the way my body felt. My arm had glided upward with incredible ease, and I was holding my back, neck, and head perfectly straight with absolutely no effort. From my position, sitting cross-legged, I stood up without using my arms and stretched. The feeling was one of total lightness. Looking at the distant mountains, I noticed that a daytime moon had been out and was about to set. It looked to be about a quarter full and hung over the horizon like an inverted bowl. Instantly, I understood why it had that shape. The sun, millions of miles directly above me, was shining only on the top of the sinking moon. I could perceive the exact line between the sun and the lunar surface, and this recognition somehow extended my consciousness outward even further. I could imagine the moon having already dipped below the horizon in the exact reflected shape it would present to those who lived further west and could still see it. Then I imagined how it would look when it moved directly under me, on the other side of the planet. To the people there, it would appear full because the sun over my head would shine past the earth and strike the moon squarely. This picture sent a rush of sensation up my spine, and my back seemed to straighten even more as I conceived, no, I experienced the same amount of space commonly felt over my head as also existing under my feet on the other side of the globe. For the first time in my life, I knew the Earth's roundness not as an intellectual concept, but as an actual sensation. At one level, this awareness excited me, but at another, it seemed perfectly ordinary and natural. All I wanted to do was immerse myself in the feeling of being suspended, floating amid a space that existed in all directions. Rather than having to push myself away from the earth with my legs as I stood there, resisting the earth's gravity, I now felt as though I was held up by some inner buoyancy, as though I was filled like a balloon with just enough helium to hover over the ground and barely touch it with my feet. It was similar to being in perfect athletic condition, as after a year of intense exercise, only far more coordinated and light. I sat down again on the rock, and again, everything seemed close. The rugged outcrop on which I was sitting, the tall trees further down the slope, and the other mountains on the horizon. And as I watched the limbs of the trees sway gently in the breeze, I experienced not just a visual perception of the event, but a physical sensation as well, as if the limbs moving in the wind were hairs on my body. I perceived everything to be somehow part of me. As I sat on the peak of the mountain looking out at the landscape falling away from me in all directions, it felt exactly as if what I had always known as my physical body was only the head of a much larger body consisting of everything else I could see. I experienced the entire universe looking out on itself through my eyes. This perception induced a flash of memory. My mind raced backward in time, past the beginning of my trip to Peru, past my childhood and my birth. The realization was present that my life did not, in fact, begin with my conception and birth on this planet. It began much earlier, with the formation of the rest of me, my real body, the universe itself. The science of evolution had always bored me, but now, as my mind continued to race backward in time, all the things I had read on the subject began to come back to me, including conversations with my friend who resembled Renault. I recalled that this was the field he was interested in, evolution. All knowledge seemed to merge with actual memories. Somehow I was recalling what had happened, and the recollection allowed me to look at evolution in a new way. I watched as the first matter exploded into the universe, and I realized, as the third insight had described, that there was nothing truly solid about it. Matter was only energy vibrating at a certain level, and in the beginning matter existed only in its simplest vibratory form, the element we call hydrogen. That's all there was in the universe, just hydrogen. I observed that hydrogen atoms began to gravitate together, as if the ruling principle, the urge of this energy, was to begin a movement into a more complex state. And when pockets of this hydrogen reached a sufficient density, it began to heat up and to burn, to become what we call a star. And in this burning, the hydrogen fused together and leaped into the next higher vibration, the element we call helium. As I continued to watch, these first stars aged and finally blew themselves up and spewed the remaining hydrogen and the newly created helium out into the universe, and the whole process began again. The hydrogen and helium gravitated together until the temperature became hot enough for new stars to form, and that in turn fused the helium together, creating the element lithium, which vibrated at the next higher level, and so on. Each successive generation of stars creating matter that had not existed before, until the wide spectrum of matter, the basic chemical elements, had been formed and scattered everywhere. Matter had evolved from the element hydrogen, the simplest vibration of energy, to carbon, which vibrated at an extremely high rate. The stage was now set for the next step in evolution. As our sun formed, pockets of matter fell into orbit around it, and one of them, the Earth, contained all the newly created elements, including carbon. As the Earth cooled, gases once caught in the molten mass migrated to the surface and merged together, forming water vapor, and the great rains came, forming oceans on the then barren crust. Then, when water covered much of the Earth's surface, the skies cleared and the sun, burning brightly, bathed the new world with light and heat and radiation. And in the shallow pools and basins, amid the great lightning storms that periodically swept the planet, matter leaped past the vibratory level of carbon to an even more complex state, to the vibration represented by the amino acids. But for the first time, this new level of vibration was not stable in and of itself. Matter had to continually absorb other matter into itself in order to sustain its vibration. It had to eat. Life, the new thrust of evolution, had emerged. Still restricted to living only in water, I saw this life split into two distinct forms. One form, the one we call plants, lived on inorganic matter and turned these elements into food by utilizing carbon dioxide from the early atmosphere. As a byproduct, plants released free oxygen into the world for the first time. Plant life spread quickly through the oceans and finally onto the land as well. The other form, what we call animals, absorbed only organic life to sustain their vibration. As I watched, the animals filled the oceans in the great age of fishes, and, when the plants had released enough oxygen into the atmosphere, began their own trek toward land. I saw the amphibians, half fish, half something new, leave the water for the first time and use lungs to breathe the new air. Then matter leaped forward again into reptiles and covered the earth in the great period of the dinosaurs. Then the warm-blooded mammals came and likewise covered the earth, and I realized that each emerging species represented life, matter, moving into its next higher vibration. Finally, the progression ended. There at the pinnacle stood humankind. Humankind. The vision ended. I had seen in one flash the entire story of evolution, the story of matter coming into being and then evolving as if under some guiding plan toward ever higher vibrations, creating the exact conditions, finally, for humans to emerge, for each of us as individuals to emerge. As I sat there on that mountain, I could almost grasp how this evolution was extended even further in the lives of human beings. Further evolution was related somehow to the experience of life coincidences. Something about these events led us forward in our lives and created a higher vibration that pushed evolution ahead as well. Yet, as hard as I tried, I couldn't quite understand. For a long time I sat on the rock precipice, consumed by peace and completeness. Then, abruptly, I became aware that the sun was beginning to sink in the west. I also noticed that toward the northwest, about a mile, was a town of some kind. I could make out the shapes of rooftops. The road on the west ridge seemed to meander right to it. I got up and began the climb down the rocks. I laughed out loud. I was still connected with the landscape, so that I felt I was walking alongside my own body, and more, that I was exploring the regions of my own body. The feeling was exhilarating. I made my way down the bluffs and into the trees. The afternoon sun cast long shadows along the forest floor. Halfway down, I came to a particularly thick area of large trees, and as I entered, I experienced a perceptible change in my body. I felt even lighter and more coordinated. I stopped and looked closely at the trees and underlying bushes, focusing on their shape and beauty. I could see flickers of white light and what seemed like a pinkish glow around each plant. I continued to walk, coming to a stream that radiated a pale blue and filled me with an enhanced tranquility and even a drowsiness. Eventually, I made my way across the valley floor and up the next ridge until I came to the road. I pulled myself up to the gravel surface and walked casually along the shoulder toward the north. Up ahead, I caught sight of a man in a priest's robe rounding the next bend. The sight thrilled me. Totally without fear, I jogged ahead to talk with him. I knew I would know exactly what to say and do. I had a feeling of perfect well-being, but to my surprise, he had disappeared. To the right, another road angled back down into the valley, but I could see no one in that direction. I ran further up the main road, but saw no one there either. I thought about going back and taking the road I had passed, but I knew the town was ahead, so I continued to walk that way. Still, I thought several more times of the other road. 100 yards farther, as I rounded another curve, I heard the roar of vehicles. Through the trees, I could see a line of military trucks approaching at a high rate of speed. For a moment, I hesitated, thinking I might stand my ground, but then I remembered the terror of the shooting on the ridge. I had time only to fling myself off the road to the right and lie still. 10 jeeps sped past me. I had landed in a spot which was completely exposed, and all I could do was hope no one looked my way. Each vehicle passed within 20 feet. I could smell the exhaust fumes and see the expression on every face. Luckily, no one noticed. After they were well past, I crawled behind a large tree. My hands were shaking and my sensation of peace and connection was totally shattered. A now familiar pang of anxiety knotted in my stomach. Finally, I inched up to the road. The sound of more vehicles sent me scurrying down the slope again as two more jeeps raced past. I felt nauseous. This time, I stayed well off the road and retreated the way I had come, moving very cautiously. I came to the road I had passed earlier. After carefully listening for sound and movement, I decided to walk through the woods beside it, angling back into the valley. My body felt heavy again. What had I been doing? I asked myself. Why had I been walking in the road? I must have been crazy, deluded by the shock of the shooting, entranced by some state of euphoria. Get real, I told myself. You have to be careful. There are people here who will kill you if you make the slightest mistake. I froze. Ahead of me, perhaps 100 feet, was the priest. He was sitting under a large tree that was surrounded by numerous rock outcroppings. As I stared at him, he opened his eyes and looked right at me. I flinched, but he only smiled and motioned for me to walk up. Cautiously, I approached him. He remained motionless. A thin, tall man of about 50 years of age. His hair was cut short and was dark brown in color, matching his eyes. "You look as though you need some help," he said in perfect English. "Who are you?" I asked. "I am Father Sanchez, and you?" I explained who I was and where I was from, dizzily sinking to one knee and then to my buttocks. "You were part of what happened in Kula, weren't you?" he asked. "What do you know of that?" I asked warily, not knowing whether to trust him. "I know someone in this government is very angry," he said. "They don't want the manuscript publicized." "Why?" I asked. He stood up and looked down at me. "Why don't you come with me? Our mission is only a half mile away. You'll be safe with us." I struggled to my feet, realizing I had no choice, and nodded affirmatively. He led me slowly down the road, his manner respectful and deliberate. He weighed each word. "Are the soldiers still looking for you?" he asked at one point. "I don't know," I replied. He said nothing for a few minutes, then asked, "Are you searching for the manuscript?" "Not anymore," I said. "Right now, I just want to survive this and go home." He nodded reassuringly, and I found myself beginning to trust him. Something about his regard and warmth affected me. He reminded me of Will. Presently, we came to the mission. There was a cluster of small houses facing a courtyard and a small church. It was situated in a place of great beauty. As we walked up, he told some of the other robed men something in Spanish, and they scurried away. I tried to see where they were going, but fatigue was engulfing me. The priest led me into one of the houses. Inside was a small living area and two bedrooms. A fire burned in the fireplace. Soon after we entered, another priest walked in with a tray of bread and soup. Wearily, I ate as Sanchez sat politely in a chair beside me. Then, upon his insistence, I stretched out on one of the beds and fell into a deep sleep. When I walked into the courtyard, I noticed immediately that the grounds were immaculately kept. The gravel walkways were edged with precisely arranged bushes and hedges. Each seemed to be placed so as to accent their full natural shape. None were trimmed. I stretched and felt the starched shirt I had put on. It was made of coarse cotton and chafed my neck slightly. Still, it was clean and freshly ironed. Earlier, I had awakened as two priests poured hot water into a tub and laid out fresh clothes. After I had bathed and dressed, I had walked into the other room and found hot muffins and dried fruit on the table. I had eaten ravenously, while the priests stood by. After I finished, the priests had left, and I walked outside to where I now stood. I walked over and sat on one of the stone benches that faced the courtyard. The sun was just clearing the tops of the trees, warming my face. "How did you sleep?" a voice asked from behind me. I turned to see Father Sanchez standing very erect, smiling down at me. "Very well," I replied. "May I join you?" "Sure." Neither of us spoke for several minutes, so long, in fact, that I felt some discomfort. Several times I looked at him, preparing to say something, but he was looking in the direction of the sun, his face tilted slightly back, his eyes squinting. Finally he spoke. "This is a nice place you found here." Apparently he meant the bench at this time of the morning. "Look, I need to ask your advice," I said. "What is the safest way for me to get back to the United States?" He looked at me seriously. "I don't know. That depends on how dangerous the government thinks you are. Tell me how you happened to be in Cula." I told him everything from the time I had first heard of the manuscript. My feeling of euphoria on the ridge now seemed fanciful and pretentious, so I only alluded to it briefly. Sanchez, however, immediately questioned me about it. "What did you do after the soldier failed to notice you and left?" he asked. "I just sat up there for a few hours," I replied. "Feeling relieved, I guess." "What else did you feel?" he asked. I squirmed somewhat, then decided to attempt a description. "It's hard to describe," I said. "I felt this euphoric connection with everything, and this total kind of security and confidence. I was no longer tired." He smiled. "You had a mystical experience. Many people report them in that forest near the peak." I nodded tentatively. He turned on the bench to face me more directly. "This is the experience the mystics of every religion have always described. Have you read anything about such experiences?" "Some years ago," I said. "But until yesterday it was only an intellectual concept?" "Yeah, I suppose." A young priest walked up and nodded to me, then whispered something to Sanchez. Sanchez nodded and the young priest turned and walked away. The older priest watched every step the young man took. He crossed the courtyard and entered a park-like area about 100 feet away. I noticed for the first time that this area, too, was also extremely clean and full of various plants. The young priest walked to several locations, hesitating at each one as though searching for something. Then at one specific location, sat down. He appeared to be engaged in an exercise of some kind. Sanchez smiled and looked pleased, then turned his attention to me. "I think it is probably unsafe for you to attempt to go back right now," he said. "But I will try to find out what the situation is, and if there is any word about your friends." He stood up and faced me. "I must attend to some chores. Please understand that we will assist you in any way possible. For now, I hope you will be comfortable here. Relax and gain your strength." I nodded. He reached inside his pocket and pulled out some papers and handed them to me. "This is the fifth insight. It speaks about the kind of experience you had. I think you might find it interesting." I took it reluctantly as he continued speaking. "What was your understanding of the last insight you read?" he asked. I hesitated. I didn't want to think about manuscripts and insights. Finally, I said, "That humans are stuck in a kind of competition for each other's energy. When we can get others to acquiesce to our view, they identify with us, and that pulls their energy into us, and we feel stronger." He smiled. "So, the problem is that everyone is trying to control and manipulate each other for energy, because we feel short of it?" "That's right." "But there is a solution, another source of energy?" "That's what the last insight implied." He nodded and walked very deliberately into the church. For a few moments, I leaned forward and rested my elbows on my knees, not looking at the translation. I continued to feel reluctant. The events of the last 2 days had dampened my enthusiasm, and I preferred instead to think of how I might return to the United States. Then, in the wooded area across the way, I noticed the young priest stand up and walk slowly to another location about 20 feet from where he was. He turned toward me again and sat down. I was intrigued over what he might be doing. Then it dawned on me that he might be practicing something that was spelled out in the manuscript. I looked at the first page and began to read. It described a new understanding of what has long been called mystical consciousness. During the last decades of the 20th century, it stated, this consciousness would become publicized as a way of being that is actually attainable, a way that has been demonstrated by the more esoteric practitioners of many religions. For most, this consciousness would remain an intellectual concept, to be only talked of and debated. But for a growing number of humans, this consciousness would become experientially real, because these individuals would experience flashes or glimpses of this state of mind during the course of their lives. The manuscript said that this experience was the key to ending human conflict in the world, because during this experience, we are receiving energy from another source, a source we will eventually learn to tap at will. I stopped reading and looked at the young priest again. His eyes were open, and he appeared to be looking directly at me. I nodded, even though I couldn't make out the details of his face. To my surprise, he nodded back to me and smiled faintly. Then he stood up and walked toward my left, heading toward the house in that direction. He avoided my eyes as I watched him cross the courtyard and enter the dwelling. Behind me, I heard footsteps and turned to see Sanchez leaving the church. He smiled as he approached me. "That didn't take long," he said. "Would you like to see more of the grounds?" "Yes, I would," I replied. "Tell me about these sitting areas you have." I pointed toward the area where the young priest had been. "Let's walk up there," he said. As we strolled across the courtyard, Sanchez told me that the mission was over 400 years old and was founded by a unique missionary from Spain, who felt the way to convert the local Indians was through their hearts, not through coercion with the sword. The approach had worked, Sanchez went on, and partly because of this success and partly due to the remote location, the priest had been left alone to follow his own course. "We carry on this tradition of looking inward for the truth," Sanchez said. The sitting area was landscaped immaculately. About half an acre of dense forest had been cleared, and the bushes and flowering plants beneath were interspersed with walkways made of smooth river stone. Like those in the courtyard, the plants here were also spaced perfectly, accentuating their unique shape. "Where would you like to sit down?" Sanchez asked. I looked around at my options. In front of us were several arranged areas, nooks which seemed complete unto themselves. All contained open spaces surrounded by beautiful plants and rocks and larger trees of varying shapes. One, to our left, where the young priest had been last sitting, had more outcroppings of stone. "How about over there?" I said. He nodded, and we walked over and sat down. Sanchez breathed deeply for several minutes, then looked at me. "Tell me more of your experience on the ridge," he said. I felt resistant. "I don't know what else I can say about it. It didn't last." The priest looked at me sternly. "Just because it ended when you became afraid again doesn't negate its importance, does it? Perhaps it is something to be regained." "Maybe," I said. "But it's hard for me to concentrate on feeling cosmic when people are trying to kill me." He laughed, then looked at me warmly. "Are you studying the manuscript here at the mission?" I asked. "Yes," he said. "We teach others how to pursue the kind of experience you had on the ridge. You wouldn't mind getting some of that feeling back, would you?" A voice from the courtyard interrupted, a priest calling for Sanchez. The older man excused himself and walked down the courtyard and talked with the priest who had summoned him. I sat back and looked at the plants and rocks nearby, taking my eyes slightly out of focus. Around the bush closest to me, I could barely make out an area of light, but when I tried it on the rocks, I could see nothing. Then I noticed Sanchez walking back. "I must leave for a while," he said as he reached me. "I'll be going into town for a meeting, so perhaps I can acquire some information concerning your friends, or at least how safe it is for you to travel." "Good," I said. "Will you be back today?" "I don't think so," he replied. "More like tomorrow morning." I must have looked insecure because he walked closer and placed his hand on my shoulder. "Don't worry. You are safe here. Please, make yourself at home. Look around. It is fine to talk with any of the priests, but understand that some of them will be more receptive than others, depending on their development." I nodded. He smiled and walked behind the church and entered an old truck I had not noticed. After several attempts, it started and he drove around the back side of the church and onto the road leading back up the ridge. For several hours I remained in the sitting area, content to gather my thoughts, wondering if Marjorie was all right and if Will had escaped. Several times the image of Jensen's man being killed flashed across my mind, but I fought off the memory and tried to stay calm. About noon, I noticed several priests were preparing a long table in the center of the courtyard with dishes of food. When they finished, a dozen or more other priests joined them and began serving their own plates and eating on the benches casually. Most of them smiled pleasantly at each other, but I could hear little talking. One of them looked up at me and pointed to the food. I nodded and walked down to the courtyard and prepared a plate of corn and beans. Each of the priests seemed very conscious of my presence, but no one spoke to me. I made several comments about the food, but my words were met only with smiles and polite gestures. If I attempted direct eye contact, they would lower their eyes. I sat down on one of the benches alone and ate. The vegetables and beans were unsalted but spiced with herbs. When lunch was over and the priests were stacking their plates on the table, another priest walked out of the church and hastily prepared a plate. When he finished, he looked around for a place to sit, and our eyes met. He smiled, and I recognized him as the priest who had looked at me from the sitting area earlier. I returned his smile, and he walked over and spoke to me in broken English. "May I sit on bench with you?" he asked. "Yes, please," I replied. He sat down and began to eat very slowly, overchewing his food and smiling up at me occasionally. He was short and small, with a wiry build and coal black hair. His eyes were a lighter brown. "You like the food?" he asked. I was holding my plate in my lap. Several bites of corn remained. "Oh, yes," I said and took a bite. I noticed again how slowly and deliberately he chewed and tried to do the same. And then it struck me that all of the priests had been eating that way. "Are the vegetables grown here at the mission?" I asked. He hesitated before answering, swallowing slowly. "Yes, food is very important." "Do you meditate with the plants?" I asked. He looked at me with obvious surprise. "You have read manuscript," he asked. "Yes, the first four insights." "Have you grown food?" he asked. "Oh no, I'm just learning about all this." "Do you see energy fields?" "Yes, sometimes." We sat in silence for a few minutes while he carefully ate several more bites. "Food is the first way of gaining energy," he said. I nodded. "But in order to totally absorb energy as food, the food must be appreciated. He seemed to be struggling for the right English word. "Savored," he finally said. "Taste is the doorway. You must appreciate taste. This is the reason for prayer before eating. It is not just about being thankful. It is to make eating a holy experience, so the energy from the food can enter your body." He looked closely at me, as though to see whether I understood. I nodded without comment. He looked thoughtful. What he was telling me, I reasoned, was that this kind of deliberate appreciation of food was the real purpose behind the normal religious custom of being thankful, with the result being a higher energy absorption of the food. But taking in food is only first step, he said. After personal energy is increased in this way, you become more sensitive to energy in all things. And then you learn to take this energy into yourself without eating. I nodded affirmatively. Everything around us, he continued, has energy. But each has its own special kind. That is why some places increase energy more than others. It depends on how your shape fits with the energy there. Is that what you were doing up there earlier, I asked. Increasing your energy? He looked pleased. Yes. How do you do that, I asked. You have to be open, to connect, to use your sense of appreciation as in seeing fields. But you take this one step further so that you get the sensation of being filled up. I'm not sure I follow you. He frowned at my denseness. Would you like to walk back to the sitting place? I can show you. Okay, I said. Why not? I followed as he led the way across the courtyard and back to the sitting area. As we arrived, he stopped and looked around, as if surveying the area for something. Over there, he said, pointing to a spot that bordered the dense forest. We followed the path as it wound through the trees and bushes. He picked a spot in front of a large tree that grew out of a mound of boulders, so that its huge trunk seemed to be perched on the rocks. Its roots wrapped around and through the boulders before finally reaching the soil. Flowering shrubs of some type grew in semicircles in front of the tree, and I could detect a strange, sweet fragrance from the shrub's yellow blossoms. The dense forest provided a solid sheet of green in the background. The priest directed me to sit down in a clear spot amid the bushes, facing the gnarled tree. He sat beside me. Do you think the tree is beautiful? He asked. Yes. Then, feel it, He seemed to be struggling again to find the word. He thought for a moment and then asked, Father Sanchez told me that you had an experience on the ridge. Can you remember how you felt? I felt light and secure and connected. How connected? That's hard to describe, I said. Like the whole landscape was part of me. But what was the feeling? I thought for a minute. What was the feeling? Then it came to me. Love, I said. I guess I felt a love for everything. Yes, he said. That is it. Feel that for the tree. But wait a minute, I protested. Love is something that just happens. I can't make myself love anything. You do not make yourself love, he said. You allow love to enter you. But to do this, you must position your mind by remembering what it felt like and try to feel it again. I looked at the tree and tried to remember the emotion on the ridge. Gradually, I began to admire its shape and presence. My appreciation grew until I actually felt an emotion of love. The feeling was exactly the one I remember as a child for my mother, and as a youth for the special little girl that was the object of my puppy love. Yet even though I had been looking at the tree, this particular love existed as a general background feeling. I was in love with everything. The priest slid away several feet and looked back at me intensely. Good, he said. You are accepting the energy. I noticed his eyes were slightly out of focus. How do you know? I asked. Because I can see your energy field getting larger. I closed my eyes and tried to reach the intense feelings I had acquired on the ridgetop, but I couldn't duplicate the experience. What I was feeling was on the same continuum, but to a lesser degree than before. The failure made me frustrated. What happened? He asked. Your energy fell. I don't know, I said. I just couldn't do it as strongly as before. He just looked at me, amused at first, then with impatience. What you experienced on the ridge was a gift, a breakthrough, a look at a new way. Now you must learn to get that experience by yourself, a little at a time. He slid back a foot farther and looked at me again. Now, try more. I closed my eyes and tried to feel deeply. Eventually, the emotion swept over me again. I stayed with it, attempting to increase the feeling by small increments. I focused my regard on the tree. That is very good, he suddenly said. You are receiving energy and giving it to the tree. I looked at him squarely. I'm giving it back to the tree? When you appreciate the beauty and uniqueness of things, he explained, you receive energy. When you get to a level where you feel love, then you can send the energy back just by willing it so. For a long time I sat there with the tree. The more I focused attention on the tree and admired its shape and color, the more love I seemed to acquire generally, an unusual experience. I imagined my energy flowing over and filling up the tree, but I couldn't see it. Without changing my focus, I noticed the priest get up and begin to walk away. What does it look like when I'm giving energy to the tree? I asked. He described the perception in detail, and I recognized it as the same phenomenon I had witnessed when Sarah projected energy onto the philodendron at Vicente. Though Sarah was successful, she apparently wasn't aware that a state of love was necessary for the projection to take place. She must have been acquiring a love state naturally without realizing it. The priest walked down toward the courtyard and out of my range of vision. I remained in the sitting area until dusk.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 3 of The Celestine Prophecy. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 4.